in the mental health field too often. We've made it seem as if it's just in your head.
The landlord can hijack the rent by 20%. That impacts people's mental health.
We can't have a profit-driven mental health care system if we want our people to be connected and healthy.
Do, 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 do. Well, why don't we just segue in this way? Okay, so yes. So dear listeners, hello. Welcome back to It's Not Just in Your Head. Harriet had this great idea this week for us to do an episode on the nuclear family, which is something I'd thought about a little bit, but not nearly to the depth that she had. And so on the phone, she started describing to me and explaining the history of the nuclear family in the context of the transition from feudalism to capitalism in sort of medieval Europe times up to, you know, industrial capitalism times. Something I knew nothing about. So I'm curious, Harriet, if you would want to kind of get into that for listeners for a little while and for us to explore related issues.
I would, because it blew my mind, really, when I read about it. And I thought, of course. And really, in a nutshell, the history of the nuclear family in many countries, but documented most carefully in France by the historian Jacques Donzelot in his book Policing the Family, which, by the way, is hardly written well. It's in the turgid academic prose of France. But what it reveals is amazing. After the French Revolution, which was a revolution against feudalism, it turned out that the population, the overwhelming majority of the population, was unemployed, didn't know where to go. Many had lived on feudal estates, which were split up, broken up. They had started being broken up before the revolution because landlords found it more profitable to have big lands, not lots of little farms, big lands where they could graze sheep. But at any rate, after the revolution, the feudal estates broke up, and the feudal family consisted of a male head of family who controlled the lives of all those beneath him with the help of his older son. And it was the feudal male head of the family who decided whether you could marry, when you could marry, what kind of lands you got, whether you had to work on your brother's lands. They were the main decision makers for your lives. And when the feudal estates broke up, there was no decision maker. Everything was chaos. There was the old order broke down, and it couldn't hold. And women were getting pregnant without any kind of security or protection. Children were being abandoned as newborns. Everyone, or not everyone, but almost everyone, was poverty-stricken and desperate for work. And at the same time, during the French Revolution particularly, there was a powerful drive to make the state responsible for the upbringing of children, which would have cost a lot of money. And those people who, after the revolution, still had the money that would be taxed to pay for that, were extremely nervous. And there were conferences between the feudal lords that had escaped death and escaped with wealth, the Catholic Church, which was a huge feudal landlord, as well as the ideological justification for feudalism, and was in many cases attacked, but also in many cases had huge lands and wealth that remained, plus the new capitalists that were growing up in the towns where dispossessed serfs went to try to eke out a living. And when they hired those people, they made money, and they were flourishing, those new capitalists, in the new capitalist France. And they thought, oh my God, if they're demanding this and they still have the fury of a recently won revolution, where will they get the money? Uh-oh, from us. And so they met together on several occasions and they worked out a solution, which they then enforced. And the solution was make every man the feudal lord of his own family. He is in charge. Give the women security in marriage to this man so that they could be supported in pregnancy and child rearing as long as they worked for this man's family. Make the children chattel so that they would have a kind of serf between them who could be rented out to work for other people, who could work on the farm, who could do whatever they were told on point of death. And in order to enforce this new arrangement, they, who were the only people with the money to give you a job, only gave jobs to men with dependent wives and children. And thus the transition was made and the nuclear family was created. Not out of nature, but out of capitalist necessity, out of saving money for the rich. And then that family, to make the to translate to the suburbs in the 1950s, that family form was encouraged by the head of housing, who was Joseph McCarthy, the famous red-baiting head of the House Un-American Activities Committee, as the head of
the king of anti-communism. Right?
Exactly, well said. And instead of, they had many choices after World War II because building funds had been halted. Everything was needed for the war effort. And now those funds were freed and the United States was the top economy in the world by far. And McCarthy had a choice, his committee. Do we invest in the cities, build up buildings where people can share washers and dryers and little green areas and childcare or whatever else? Or do we build up suburbs, vast tracts where little individual homes could be built? McCarthy felt it was communist to share anything. And he had his way. And they endorsed and invested in huge suburban communities like Levittown, which, by the way, in Levittown, you of course had to be married to get a house. You had to be married to a white person and you had to be white. Black people weren't allowed there. You couldn't have black friends. You couldn't have more than two children. You had to have your own appliances rather than share, and they had to be ordered from GE. You can imagine the money GE gave to McCarthy's campaigns. However, that is all beautifully documented in a chapter of the book Picture Windows, A History of the American Suburbs by Rosalind Baxendall and Liz Ewan. It's very carefully researched in a scholarly way. So between the capitalist decision to save money by making the man the head of the feudal household with dependents, so he better not go on strike because the whole family would suffer, and giving his wife a secondary role but protected in childbirth and child rearing, and making the children chattel, they instituted the nuclear family. This is hardly natural.
So, okay. All right, let's talk about this.
So, it's a lot.
It's a lot. But I think for a lot of listeners, I mean, one reaction I had when I first started thinking about this a while ago, and then I was revisiting it over the phone when you were explaining this transition, my first reaction was, well, what other arrangement of social organization is there? You know, like you have the man and wife. So this is the sort of bias of assumptions that I think most ordinary people would have, is that, okay, well, you have a man and a wife, assuming a heteronormative, like, you know, straight people relationship, you got a man and a wife, get married, they have 1 point whatever kids, and they settle down in a single family home in a suburb somewhere. And that's normal. That's like a natural arrangement of humans. And then you just multiply that throughout a whole section of a city in a suburb, and that's just how people are supposed to operate, right? So that there was a gut reaction even I had as like being, you know, left-wingy guy person. And I started to wonder, like, what other arrangements of social organization are there? What were there before? What are there in other cultures and in other countries? And I can't say at this point I'm an expert. I do have some ideas. But do you have any immediate answers to that question, either from a historical or cross-cultural perspective?
Yes. I mean, in the early caves, they never found just a wife, husband, and children. Mm-hmm. They found a grouping of about 10 people, and people lived in tribal configurations. And in order to survive, they lived in what you'd call a primitive communism, in which, you know, they couldn't afford a class of people to rule over them who they taxed. They didn't have enough. A good example that we all can recognize is the Iroquois, who were by and large a communal society. And the way they organized it is men and women had children, but when the children were born, it was a matrilineal arrangement. The woman and her brother and her family raised the children. And men and women lived together until one of them, usually the woman it turned out, decided this is not a good arrangement. And if the woman owned the tent and the women were in charge of the longhouse where many lived, and the woman would show, "I'm done," by putting her husband's belongings outside the tent. So he got the hint. And children were raised communally. There's a famous quotation with a missionary talking to the Lakota Sioux, a Lakota Sioux Native American. And the missionary says, "You guys better keep better track of your wives. You don't even know who your children are." And the Lakota Sioux man says, "I don't understand. They're all my children. All the children in this tribe are my children." It's a very different idea. And even as late as post-World War II, while the American Dream was going on, there were all sorts of alternative arrangements, because across the world, there were millions of children whose parents had been exterminated or were lost. And one group was children whose parents had been killed in the concentration camps, but the kids somehow survived. And there were whole communities of children being brought up by communities of committed people. And in Hungary, they had wonderful orphanages. And through those, they found, through their research, that children can bond from birth with between one and five caretakers, form an intimate bond, and they made sure that happened. And they were brought up as a group. The kibbutzim in Israel did that without driving anybody nuts, and that was a recent example. But also to this day, in Russia, there's something called kitez, K-I-T-E-Z-H, where there are communities where parents who have their own children also are connected and open their homes to children whose parents have abandoned them or who have been taken away by the state because their parents are so horrendously cruel. Mm-hmm. And they can switch to a different family if they feel like it. But all the families and everyone in the kitez community, from the cook and the gardener to the teachers to the heads of every family, meet and figure out where the children are and what to do that's best for the next generation. And this has been a very successful model, so that people grow up in family homes that are connected to a community and can choose. Because really, the nuclear family is based on the supposition that whoever gets pregnant even if they were knocked up by mistake, is capable of having the patience and knowledge to be responsible for a totally dependent life 24 hours a day. That's a pretty whacked assumption. And doesn't work necessarily very well.
Well, something else that comes to mind to me when I think about, so the capitalist workplace structure that's also kind of evolved from this bizarre obsession with top-down hierarchy of like you get one boss or, you know, one owner, or maybe you have like a mini collective of shareholders. They decide a bunch of stuff and they tell the managers what to do and the managers tell the workers what to do. That that there's this weird assumption, I think, in our culture where there's, you have the individual, which is like, that's actually a weird idea in and of itself, an individual that's sort of separate from everybody else. If you have an individual man or individual woman, and they're supposed to be sort of the ultimate decider, almost like a mini authoritarian in their own lives, at least supposedly, or maybe this is kind of what, how like libertarians think or something. But then all of a sudden you get this thing called a marriage where now there's this two-person decision-making unit. Although it's conservatively, you're not supposed to assume that there's sort of a 50%, 50% decision-making power. It's typically like the patriarchal thing that the man typically is supposed to assume, and gay and lesbian marriages are just sort of invalid. There just isn't really a decision-making process. They're just supposed to not exist or something. but within like a family, so when you have a marriage and you have a family unit and you have like a single family home and you have this like copy-pasted suburbia, this, so I'm also thinking if you zoom out, if you looked at a single neighborhood, like there wouldn't really be anything stopping people from constructing neighborhood councils, for example, where you have, say, anywhere between 10 and 30 families from a couple blocks of houses coming together to make important decisions about things related to their family, about domestic life, about social relations, about resource sharing, about child rearing. There shouldn't be anything that stops people from doing something like that, where you could actually expand the governance from a two-person model to like a 10 to 50-person model. Somehow you include children or you include adolescents, you include extended family members of some kind. You know, this is something that could happen. And we also, any listeners who know any, for example, urban planners or like housing cooperative development specialists or something like that, we would actually love to have someone like that on a future episode, because I think the attention to the built environment and the way that it impacts social organization and potential alternative governance models of decision making within social organization, it's really crucial. But kind of going back to what we have now, like when I think of my neighborhood, there's a bunch of single family homes and basically no one talks to each other. Some people who have been lucky enough to stick around for long enough because they either inherited the home or down payments and loans to pay for mortgages were affordable back when people did purchase their homes. Some neighbors have known each other for a long time, but as with most places, there's this influx of new people. If there's a new younger couple who's buying a house, they either, it's almost guaranteed that they work in tech or finance or something similar to that. And almost nobody else can actually buy a home. And again, no one talks to each other. And it's just assumed that there's a sort of separation between everyone within the single family homes, within their streets, that the streets were designed for cars to get family members from their place of home to their place of employment and back, and maybe occasional vacations or something. But that's really what the function of the road is and what the car is and what the home is. So you have these tiny units of sort of separated decision-making structures where presumably the man's making all the decisions, although it's not really how it works. And no one's really coming together to decide things as a larger group. It's a mindfuck, to be honest, to think, how did we get to this place where the vast majority of people, I would assume, think that it is normal and it's natural for you to have a sort of a man and a wife sort of arrangement, that they are separate from everyone else and they are supposed to sort of govern themselves and their family independent of everyone else.
Yeah, it's strange.
It's strange, but it's like it's normal. It's sort of like the air we're breathing, right?
Yes, and in some cultures, people are more connected. Like in France, almost everyone is politically connected in something, mm-hmm. and the children are connected because they go to quality child cares, and from 3 years old on, public education is 100% available and utilized, and so they grow up with other children with a sense of solidarity, and they can stay there as early as 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and be picked up, bathed, and fed, and so on. So they have a solidarity, but even in a big apartment house, everybody's in their separate little unit, and that's not necessary. In Sweden, before the latest recession, coronavirus stuff, they were building buildings with the idea that people live alone much more. Like in New York, 60% in Manhattan, New York City, 60% of people live alone. And that was true in Stockholm also. So especially for younger people. And so they began to build apartments that had small private units. You know, you'd have a tiny little kitchen with a louvered door and, you know, a bedroom. But then big collective units where there were films, where there were dinners that people could make together, where there were activities, and so that people could connect with one another. Now, there are such shared facilities in San Francisco, but they're wildly expensive, where single people who have a job that pays well or other big monies can have a small apartment and a big collective space so that they can connect with people. There's also co-housing, which is housing in which a bunch of people are connected, either in an apartment complex or on a street, and some of them have children and some of them don't, but they plan things together and the kids can go visit different people. They have a sign showing whether the kids are welcome to stop by or not, and they have collective facilities. There are old age facilities in New York, which were very successful. This facility where they took a single room occupancy rundown hotel and got a lot of money. I forget the woman's name who did this, but she got a lot of money together and made lovely little rooms and big collective spaces for people who were poor and old and on Medicare. And they had films and games and all sorts of entertainments in a collective space. And they ate together if they wanted to. And they found that people's Medicare bills plummeted because they didn't get sick so much when they were happy.
Right.
My own grandmother, when I was growing up, lived on 79th Street, Manhattan, in what was called a professional's apart hotel, where she had a little tiny apartment with, you know, a kitchen, you know, a closet kitchen with louvered doors and a little living room and a little bedroom and a bathroom. And there was a big dining room downstairs because she was a lawyer and lived alone. And it was full of people with jobs who lived alone and met each other at dinner. And so that they felt that they were connected. There are all sorts of things, but capitalism wants everybody to buy their own and not relate to anyone else in a group that might rebel.
Well, I mean, the other thing is, so anybody listening to this who maybe lives in like a multi-unit apartment complex that's just owned by some guy or like a commercial real estate.
Yeah,
exactly. A corporation where that apartment complex is seen as like almost like a factory where it's just making money, just like owning, I don't know, a Coca-Cola factory or just whatever, where they look at like, okay, if there's 10 units at like $2,000 per unit, okay, that's how much money we make. Maybe we put a little bit to pay a property manager and there's a little bit of maintenance fees, but we mostly let it fall into disrepair because it saves us money and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Me and the tenants unit I organize with, we knock the doors of a lot of big multifamily or multi-unit apartment buildings like every weekend. And we found this one that was about 20 units. And the way it was constructed was like there was a barbecue kind of in the center. Like, how do I describe this? When you walk out of your door, there's two stories and you can see doors of other people. So it's sort of enclosed, like you're in your apartment, you come out and you can see the other units. So, you know, I was thinking this has a lot of potential for people to hang out in the courtyard. And it didn't really seem like people did. I mean, some of the folks that had lived there for between, say, 5 to 15 years did seem to, some of them had built some relationships and they, you know, so we'd knock on one door and say, okay, do you guys have any issues with your landlord? And they'd say, oh, we don't, but so-and-so does over there. And they'd walk us over. And that was pretty cool. But it didn't seem like they had any sort of, like it wasn't organized. And I guess these things don't have to be like hyper-organized or anything. But imagine, dear listeners, in this type of building, if you live in this type of building, imagine you and the other people who live there sort of collectively own it. And so how a housing co-op works is typically you have a nonprofit entity and there's a board of people, let's say 5 to 7 people, and they get to decide things related to the housing, like the property. So like, let's say you and a bunch of people live in this apartment complex and there's a board. It's not like shareholders. It's not people trying to maximize profit, but it's community members, typically at least a few people who actually live in the buildings, and they get to talk about management issues that relate to, say, I don't know, mold or like plumbing issues. And also, like, is the rent too high? Do we need to lower the rent? Is the rent too low? Do we need to up the rent because we still need to pay the mortgages back or whatever? But in between all of that, typically there's something like monthly meetings where it can be just like people eating together, or it can be we're talking about other issues, like how can we help each other out with things like, hey, say childcare, or should we put together a fun activity for the kids for them to like do sidewalk chalk art like down the street, and who's going to supervise the kids as we do it? These also are ways that people organize themselves. It is rare in the US, but these are possibilities. These actually are within our reach, like right now. Like, we could all be trying to put in some time to organize ourselves to collectively own our apartment buildings, convert them into housing co-ops, or have them be a part of community land trusts and other similar arrangements like that. But they're just not well known. Like, most people, no. It wasn't until the last few years that I started learning about these other modes of sort of collective ownership and management of land and people living together. And in fact, I actually live in a place where we don't collectively own it, but we do sort of, we have pretty regular meetings, and it, you know, the meetings can be about like, we need to get better at doing our chores. So-and-so, you're not doing your chores or whatever. It can be that kind of thing. It can also be like for event planning. We used to have monthly living room open mics that we'd invite all our friends to. When COVID happened, obviously we can't do that anymore, but like we organize reading groups. And you know, I've had people tell me when I explain to them that lifestyle, they say, oh, well, I couldn't live with people like that and like have these meetings and all that kind of stuff. But from those same people, I'm often hearing like, either I want to get married and settle down, or I'm too busy with my family and my kids. And I just kind of wonder sometimes, like, what's so different about a quasi-collective way of living your life physically where you live with other people and trying to manage a family with kids?
It would be easier because you would have other people, you know, and it really, I'm old enough so that I remember living in a New York apartment when I was really little, and it was before the drug epidemic. So people left their doors open. Used to be that in New York apartments, not only tenements, but always in tenements, and then in New York apartments, people left their doors open because it wasn't a drug epidemic or a crime epidemic. And as a little girl, I mean, I went around and visited all sorts of people, said who let me sit in the kitchen, gave me some cocoa or something, and got to know the people in my building. And when I first moved into the co-op building I'm in, which in name, we each have shares in it, but the feeling is not cooperative. But when I first moved in, everyone used to manage together and everyone had a job. And then some of the people left and a sort of corporate person took over as chair. And wanted to hire a management company, and so that the whole thing dissolved. They still have meetings about the furnace or whatever. They do, not the rest of us. And that feeling of community, which was so sustaining, disappeared. But of course it's possible. And it ought to be built in, literally. And that's what we hope to talk about.
You know, and I, so when in our little skit, you mentioning the statistics on marriage, divorce, family violence, domestic violence, that's the other thing that I feel like, I mean, we could spend probably a whole other episode on this because we don't have the time, but the fantasy about a nuclear family providing security and safety and stability and happiness, I think hopefully we made clear that we're not telling people to not have that family. I mean, it's almost impossible to not have some family arrangement of that kind or be adjacent to it. You know, if you're not in a sort of proper nuclear family, you probably know a lot of people who are. It's not like there's anything, we're not judging it. We're just, we're also just sort of, we're describing the reality, which is that they're not, you're not guaranteed safety or security or happiness, because the statistics actually show that quite the opposite is true in at least half, if not most, nuclear family arrangements. So with that said, I think that also my sort of response to people I know who are like, well, I want to settle down and have a family and all that stuff, and I wouldn't want to live in a housing cooperative or have these, I don't know, neighborhood councils or whatever sort of seemingly fantastical kind of stuff that I tend to talk about with people. I just, you know, I kind of think like, well, so you'd rather have a coin toss on whether or not you're going to be physically abused by someone that loves you and that your kids are going to end up having like serious attachment issues and developing drug problems in their teens because you're too busy working to actually raise them. What makes you, where did you learn to believe that you going into this whole family thing, like you're just going to win the lottery by going into it, and that you wouldn't want to try to engage in a larger collective project that sort of improves your life and other people's lives and models to the rest of the world a better way of socially organizing yourself with other people? You know, and so for me, it's actually a constant point of kind of frustration, if not depression, like looking around and seeing, you know, I'm 35 now and I'm looking around, and it is a lot more common for millennials around my age to not opt in to the nuclear family thing because economically it's so much harder for us now to even consider doing that. But then those that are still sort of fantasizing about that, it makes me really sad sometimes thinking, you know, I don't think that's going to work out exactly how you think it's going to, you know, once you have all the paperwork signed and things are now like legally bound, and in 5 to 10 years, things might change. I mean, really for the worse for you. And especially I think as therapists, you know, we've seen, you see so many divorces and separations and family violence kinds of things that, you know, are confidential. So you can't talk about like excruciating details with anyone, but the amount of pain is just so immense and it's so sad. And for some reason, it's like, I feel like America's still under the spell of thinking that that's not actually the norm within families, when it's again, it's a coin toss, you know, it's a dice roll. Are you going to have a happy family? You're going to have like a nightmarish, violent family. It's a dice roll.
So. And there's a lot in between. There's a lot of just alienation and loneliness. Carly Simon had a wonderful song that says, you know, you want to marry me? That's, and have a family. That's the way I always heard it should be. You want to marry me? I'll marry. You know, we'll marry. And then, but it's poignant because she says the couples cling and claw and drown in love's debris. Because most of us aren't really brought up to know our own feelings, to being asked, to ask for what we want, to tell other people that we don't like something they're doing and we want them to change. We're not prepared for that. We're prepared for families in which people play roles, kind of impersonate family roles, and feel alienated and lonely. And that's changing as the conditions of economic existence for those families crumble. Because, you know, that men can't support wives and dependent children. And mm-hmm. women aren't home to raise their children. Mm-hmm. And marriages usually don't last. And so that yeah. fantasy has to be recognized as a fantasy that could only be achieved with cooperation from both parties and hard mm-hmm. work.
Well, or if, like you were saying with the Levittown model, I mean, so being a sort of, you know, white middle class nuclear family was so extremely subsidized during mm-hmm. that sort of peak 1950s fantasy
right.
decade or whatever. And some of those subsidies are still there, although, you know, they've been largely eroded. You know, white privilege still has, you know, a significant enough degree of sort of like economic subsidies built into it, but, you know, not, you know, sometimes people in the identity politic world forget, like, there's a lot more poor white people mm-hmm. Now than we like to think. But it's just a lot harder to achieve that fantasy now, like you're saying, because of the economic changes. And the thing is, it was just kind of a fantasy back then too, though. Mm-hmm. That's the other issue. You know more statistics on this than I do, but I mean, I'm more aware of the statistics on family violence and child abuse and stuff mm-hmm. right now. I don't know what they were in the 1950s, but I'd imagine that there was a lot of crazy shit happening within the so-called ideal picket fence Levittown families, but we kind of get the propaganda end of it. You know, we get mm-hmm. the photos of the shining white teeth and the wife in her dress standing in front of the newly built car and everything. But I do wonder what were the rates of domestic violence there, or the rates of alcoholism from the dad who's just totally checked out after his, the job that probably was a pretty hard and exhausting job. And he comes home and he's just like, bitch, get me a beer kind of attitude. You know? I mean, I think a lot of that was the norm. It's just not really talked about.
Well, it might not have been talked about because the battered child syndrome and the laws around it, the battered child syndrome was written in 1962. And so that before that you could, and before 1967, when the laws were in place, you could kill your kid. And as long as you said he fell down the stairs or, you know, someone's tricycle ran him over or something, they couldn't question you. And so they didn't have statistics on domestic violence because it wasn't recognized. And until the 1980s, domestic violence was a man's or a woman's right. I mean, that what went on in the family was outside the legal system. Mm-hmm. Marital rape wasn't declared a crime in all states until close to the 1990s.
Violence Against Women Act or something?
Yeah, then there was the Violence Against Women Act. There were various things that allowed women. There were battered women's shelters before battered women had nowhere to go and got 59 cents on the mail dollar, so there's no way they could leave and support their children. Mm-hmm. There were no protections and there was no acknowledgement, so you could feed that fantasy. That fantasy is kind of hinted at in that very popular movie, The Shape of Water, where the evil guy is the military CIA guy and his wife and independent little family is contrasted to the soulful relationships between the creature in The Shape of Water, the aquatic creature, and also between the women who work together. Because it didn't start being recognized until Betty Friedan wrote her book in 1965, The Problem That Has No Name, about the anomie, the alienation and the loneliness of the suburban housewife and the extent to which they were taking tranquilizers to try to fit the dream that didn't fit. So it's only our recent history that allows us to measure these things or acknowledge these problems in the nuclear family.
Right. It's really crazy to consider. I mean, I think I've mentioned this before. My official title is marriage family therapist. And it's not because I wanted to, when I decided in my like mid to late 20s that I wanted to be a therapist, I just wanted to generally be a therapist. And I was looking at programs that I could get into and then, you know, do the thing I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And the easiest one, because it was just nearby at Antioch, and it was like, I didn't have to have some like astounding GRE score or anything, was a track to get into to be an MFT. And so it's ironic sometimes that I think that we think this way, Harriet, and that I think this way, and that I actually do quite a lot of family therapy with people. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever really talked about these things with clients, and I actually don't know how many clients I have who have like discovered this podcast yet. I'm like sort of fearful of that, but may find out like what I really think about things. But it is kind of sad, because sometimes it's like what I'm doing. I don't know how much family therapy you do, but with family therapy, sometimes on the one hand, it's actually kind of a beautiful thing. I actually really enjoy doing family therapy. I like working with groups of people more than individuals sometimes, and trying to kind of work out, okay, well, what's the dynamic between you two versus you two? And then, you know, there's the identified patient thing. Well, like, well, we think that person is the issue. Okay, well, what's your role in the conflict? I actually really like doing that stuff. It's really fun. It's like, it keeps me on my toes. It's when you get sort of insights from multiple people who are interacting all the time together, you start to see, I think, much more interesting results and shifts in dynamics within the group more than just working with individuals. However, it's funny because, so even if you think about the sort of trickle down through history of the transition from feudalism to capitalism to this McCarthyist like hyper construction of the nuclear family that's been reinforced by various laws, and now the sort of, it's just the hegemony of the culture. Even doing family therapy or marriage therapy or couples therapy, again, this probably sounds crazy, but like, why not therapy for people like neighborhood therapy, or like apartment building therapy or something, right?
Yes, or like, just
these are all
discussions. Yeah. I mean, really, they're every therapist, it's such a perfect example of the doublethink that surrounds us. Every therapist deals with the detritus, you know, the destructive apparatus that's torn up like a crumbling building in marriages and relationships, and yet they don't question the institution itself and what could be done and how it could be replaced.
Right.
Even though they see family destruction every day. Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe we'll have a part two. There's one leftist urban planner that I've been chatting with online, seeing if I can get them to talk with us. Maybe we could have a sort of part two with more attention to the sort of built environment or something like that. And I'm thinking maybe we could cut it for now.
Yes, and welcome suggestions. Because also, if you people, if you want to take this in a certain direction, let us know. Mm-hmm. Don't just support us on Patreon, which we'd love. But also let us know what you think.
Absolutely. And also, that said, when I think of, say, like sort of more sort of traditional, like Mexican families, for example, that I know, the extended family is more common. And I think in a lot of sort of traditional or oftentimes immigrant families, I think because of certain economic constraints, that's actually one factor. But I think it's also that I think the extended family is probably a more quote unquote natural.
Yes.
Maybe more natural thing, right? I mean, a nuclear family has to be really shaped into a society for people to think that it's like man, wife, two kid or whatever. But anybody that has either if you are more familiar with a different family structure, or if you've been living in like a co-housing community for 10 years or something, if you actually have experience outside of a nuclear family and you want to speak about how it's different from the nuclear family from your perspective, or maybe what some of the challenges are, too, because there's really no like utopian ideal. Or if there's like, you know, scholars and academics who are, I know there's a lot of feminists out there that have written extensively about like the quote unquote abolish the family concept, or just deeper critiques of the family, the nuclear family. So please, please email us at itsnotjustinyourhead@gmail.com. If you'd want to either get on the podcast or point us in a new direction of folks to talk to. And also, I advise whoever is listening to this to look outside of your home and look at your neighborhood and through this lens, right? Wondering how was that built the way it was built? And why are people socially organized within that building the way that they are organized? And why are we so separate?
Yes, right? Good questions.
You're not going to come up with solutions to the question of how do we change it? This is really hard. But just start putting on that those glasses to look at your own neighborhood and see what happens.
That's a super idea. And thank you all so much for listening and supporting us in whatever way you can.
By the way, listeners, if you have enjoyed anything you've heard Harriet say in this program, you will definitely enjoy Capitalism Hits Home, which is a solo program that Harriet does through Democracy at Work, which is a worker-owned cooperative that produces other great programs such as Economic Update with Richard Wolff and the Anti-Capitalist Chronicles with David Harvey. I can't recommend enough that everyone also listen to Capitalism Hits Home if you enjoy It's Not Just in Your Head.
Capitalism Hits Home is a sort of broader overhead view. It explores the way that capitalism shapes our personal lives, our psyches, our relationships, our families, and it looks particularly at the sea change in American personal life as all Americans but the top 10 or 20% of Americans have our security and our chance for a future become as precarious as it always was for minorities and families headed by women. It's not just in your head, and Capitalism Hits Home are definitely complementary.
And if listeners would like to check out Capitalism Hits Home, Harriet, where should they go to find it?
Either on YouTube or Democracy at Work or on my own website, harrietfraud.com.